Welcome. Good morning. I'm Ilona Marx, here for What Matters. What Matters from the perspective of mind, body, and spirit. And we have a guest on this morning who was recommended by one of our listeners to the show because it matters to her that we try and build bridges between the different religious organizations and have more of an understanding of how it all works. So this morning I'm very pleased to have with me the executive director of Ask Noah, Ask Noah International. His name is Michael Shulman. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for joining us, and welcome to What Matters. Your website speaks about how you can become a beacon of light to dispel the darkness and to learn to live and reach out to others with acts of goodness and acts of kindness. So now, certainly that can't be a bad thing, and certainly something that we need more of in this day and age, and I know that you are trying to bridge those gaps and build communication. What exactly is Ask Noah International, if you could just give us more of an understanding of that?
We are a charitable organization, and we were founded in the mid-1990s exactly for the purpose that you mentioned, to build these bridges and to reach out and encourage people doing acts of goodness and kindness. But also, we are a religious outreach organization, which is kind of unique, which is observant Jews reaching out to the non-Jews of the world to bring them their part in the Hebrew Bible, in the Torah, because that is definitely there, and there are commandments there for all mankind, very basic and fundamental commandments, which that is the destiny where the world is going.
When you say that the destiny of the world is going, you're saying towards a world that will be more universally of a higher consciousness, more accepting of a divine presence in the world. That prophecy by Isaiah about turning weapons into plowshares.
Exactly, that is correct.
Okay, so let's make it very clear that you do not in any way try to convert people to your religion. You're not trying to have people become Jewish. On the contrary, you try and just encourage people to become more understanding through understanding the origins of the religion.
That is correct. Everyone from any faith should look back to the roots of faith, which is in the one God. And in recognizing that, then there are questions, what does that one God expect of me as a human being created in God's image? And that's the mission that Abraham and Sarah went out with when they were really alone in the world in promoting monotheism. And they reached out to their whole society, as many people as they could, to teach them about the Creator, and that everything comes from the Creator, and therefore a person who partakes of the creation has an obligation to be thankful, to realize that his needs are being met by the Creator, and therefore if he has a need, he should ask or pray for that. So it's a baseline that unites all humanity.
To me, it's interesting why Abraham is such a big link between all the different religions, because Islam and Judaism and Christianity, and it even says Hinduism, all emanates out of Abraham's presence, such a huge, huge figure in the world history.
Yes, that's right. If you go back even farther, there's a person who is even more fundamental, which is Noah, because the whole human race was reestablished through him, and it was him who God actually made a covenant, called the Covenant of the Rainbow. God made the promise that the world would never have to be in such a low spiritual state that it would have to be destroyed. And on the other hand, the obligation was given to human beings to uphold seven basic fundamental principles of interaction between people and their fellow human beings and people and their Creator. And based on that fundamental covenant, they established very early on the direction that the world needed to go. And unfortunately, after Noah, for a period of time, the world digressed into idolatry. And it was Abraham who came back and rekindled that light. And his way of doing that was through acts of goodness and kindness.
It certainly seems that now, I know you said that that there was a covenant that the world would never reach such a low point again that it would have to be destroyed, but it certainly seems that way now, and maybe it seems that way in every generation. People look around at the world that they live in and just see that 2012 is carrying such a big energy, and there's so much speaking about destruction and Armageddon and the end of times and all this other stuff. How do you explain that in terms of the destruction from the flood and how it might impact or reflect on what's going on today?
Well, there's a very fundamental difference, which is that in the time before the flood, the people were definitely warned and the people were requested and pleaded to improve their ways, but there was no redeeming interest in doing so. It was actually part of this covenant which God made with Noah. It was actually a covenant on the effectiveness of repentance, that people would have an inborn sense of right and wrong as part of their human psyche that would hold them back from crossing over that line and realizing and acting on the fact that if a person does make a mistake or a person does go down the wrong path, the door is always open for them to return to God through personal, sincere repentance. And it's just that fact that that opening is there that keeps the world from degenerating to such a point as it had before. Now, there might be situations where locally you could have a very bad situation, but on the whole, on the average, the world is actually improving and becoming a better place. And it's hard to see because we focus on the bad.
Yeah.
But if you look at the good, you'll see that the good, which is what really matters, is actually improving, and it's carrying us over to where all those good things that were promised are going to happen very soon.
I agree with you. I think that in the midst of all of the chaos and in the midst of all of the war that we see, and it may not look that way because of all the turmoil, that we're actually entering into a time period where we are shifting into a more enlightened consciousness collectively and individually. And it seems like your organization, Ask Noah International, is helping build bridges so that all the different religions can learn from these seven laws that were given to Noah, seven Noahide laws. Can we go through some of them so that people can know what they are? What are the seven laws that were given to all mankind? And how does it differ from the Ten Commandments?
I can list for you the seven universal commandments, but you have to also realize that each one has many details in practicality and branches off, so it's not a simple matter of just seven. There's a whole theology and a scholarship that goes into understanding what the ramifications of these are. And I'm not going to list them in a particular order, but they are actually prohibitions. There are things which people are not supposed to do so that they don't cross over those limitations.
That right there differs from the Ten Commandments, because the Ten Commandments says things that you must do.
Right. Those are for Jews.
Okay. All right. So let's go through the seven Noahide laws.
There's a prohibition against idolatry, which is worshiping any force or creation, meaning that one should only worship God. So there is a corollary positive that goes with the negative. So not to worship idolatry means only worship the one God.
Okay, so monotheism is one of the tenets of this.
Right. Then, once that's established, the next prohibition is not to curse the Creator, not to blaspheme, which is very specific because there is a special holy name of God which is revealed in the Bible in the holy language of Hebrew, which we call that the Tetragrammaton, and is not even spoken, so that is not to curse him. So that is the second of the commandments. Then there are commandments not to murder.
So far it sounds quite similar, because the one about, wasn't the commandment in the Ten Commandments is about taking the God's name in vain, sounds similar to the blasphemy, and now not murdering is another one that is very similar.
There is definitely overlap.
Michael, before we go back to the list of the seven Noahide laws that you were speaking about, let's just take this call.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know it. The Noahide laws were signed into U.S. law in 1992 under George Bush Sr. In House Joint Resolution 104, which became Public Law 102-14 in the 102nd Congress. So the United States is actually living under Noahide laws. And could you talk about the early Sanskrit, the early cuneiform documents that 2,600 years old, the epics of Gilgamesh, that were uncovered in early Sumeria?
Okay, let me just ask you something. It sounds like you know a lot about this. Do you know what the correlation is between the Sanskrit texts?
The first books are basically almost identical to stories of the flood and creation that are listed in a tablet that dates back to 2600 BC from the earliest, this basically the earliest documents ever found that were discovered on stone tablets in the 19th century in what is now today Iraq, that are It's hard to explain how these stories could have originated with the authors of the Bible when they were uncovered and found to predate by 1200 to 1400 years the time of Moses, who is indicated to have written these first five books. I just wanted to ask a scholar. I'm not arguing with him. I'm just asking if he could explain that.
Okay, first of all, I want to clarify something. There was an inaccuracy in the first statement that was made, and I've heard it before, about the Noahide laws being enacted as law of the land in the United States, and the United States living under Noahide law. That's really not the case. What the Carr was referring to is that, and I have to give a little bit of background here about the Noahide movement and how that act of Congress came about. The modern Noahide movement was really launched by a great religious leader of our time, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Menachem Schneerson, who became the head of the Lubavitcher Hasidic movement in 1951.
And he was really a visionary of a human being, really a very far-sighted and all-encompassing visionary and sage, but also a mathematician, a physicist, a scholar.
Yes, that's all correct. And he was not only visionary in specific areas, but he was visionary on a global scale in the direction that the world is taking in our times. And very soon, almost immediately after he assumed the leadership in his Hasidic discourses, he began including comments and insights and directions about the religious obligations of non-Jews in terms of their Torah law, which is the Noahide law. And this was an area that, historically, that was definitely a part of Judaism, and Judaism always had a universal outreach to non-Jews. And in ancient Israel, there were non-Jewish residents who were allowed to be citizens of the land of Israel, and they were only required to keep these seven laws in exchange for their citizenship.
So how does this tie in, though, with what he was speaking about in Congress? You said that he had made a misstatement about the inclusion of that by George Bush Sr.
Right, because in the year that this was passed, the Congress signed an act making the Rebbe's birthday National Education Day, which falls out right before Passover. This began with the first President Bush, and every president after that and every Congress after that reestablished every year the Rebbe's birthday as National Education Day, because one of the Rebbe's main topics was the need for proper education for the sake of the society. In that document, which you can actually read that act of Congress, so the language there talks about the importance of education, and they're saying that there are fundamental principles that this land was founded on, and in ancient times, those were called the Noahide laws. So it's saying that there are principles in the Noahide laws that are reflected in the principles of our country.
Okay. All right. So, and if we just have a minute to answer the second part of his question, which is about these ancient Sanskrit texts that were found that predate Moses by 1,400 years.
Well, he is obviously speaking about things that the Torah talks about, which predated Moses by thousands of years. And as you can easily research in cultures all over the world, in their ancient traditions, there are stories about a worldwide flood and humanity being saved by an individual, a few families, who the creator, the power who brought on this flood, kept them as a saving remnant. And as we also know, that Abraham had a very wide influence in the world, and he was known far and wide.
Michael, can we just get back, because I want to get through these seven laws, because so far we've got into the monotheistic is one of the seven Noahide laws. The second one was blasphemy, to not be taking God's name in vain. The third one was to not kill, and I don't think we need to spend too much time on that one, because although humanity seems to have lost its way to the point that that is a current occurrence, we don't need to discuss why it's a bad thing. And let's go on to the next one.
Yes, so the next one I would mention would be the prohibition of theft, which is something that probably one of the ones that people have to be most careful about, because there's so many situations that come up in daily life where you might be tempted to take something that doesn't belong to you. Then there is the...
So stealing, theft, stealing is to not take other people's property.
Exactly.
Okay.
Now, you can branch it off into things. Right now, there is a very big national debate about copyrighted material being used without permission on the Internet. So that is...
Yes, that is interesting, and I was just about to ask you about that. What does that say about that? What would the Torah say about using material off the Internet that isn't yours?
Well, interesting. I'll mention another one of the laws of the Noahide Code is for the society to establish laws and courts for itself to govern civil matters. So if a country defines something legally as theft, then the citizens of that country therefore become bound to respect that. And so the question of copyright law is interesting because the Noahide prohibition of theft deals with monetary damages. So if it was going to come under that heading, you'd have to look at how is someone being monetarily damaged and losing his income because of that. Otherwise, it goes into a civil matter, which is covered by the commandment for laws and courts.
Okay, so those two kind of go together and how you would deal with them. So they suggest to go by whatever the court system that is established in each country and the way that that is set up, to go by according to those laws and rules.
Yes, within reason. Absolute power corrupts absolutely, so there is the possibility that a government could become corrupt and start introducing laws that really are regressive and hurtful to the populace, and they're not serving the purpose.
I wouldn't say that there's a possibility that a government can come be corrupt. It seems like government is the definition of corruption these days. So all around the world, it seems the definition of corruption these days and theft and burglary seems to be government. So that's another whole discussion for a different day. But
right, but now we have an absolute standard to judge that by, which is the Noahide Code. So if the government goes over that line, where the government is actually stealing and murdering, then you know that you've got problems and something needs to happen. Either it's going to happen for the population, or the one above who's directing the world will, in one way or another, straighten out what's happening with that country.
Well, it's rampant all around the world, and there are countries right now that are living under rules that are incredibly cruel, where there is no court system, with very barbaric rules, even in 2012.
Right. But with the Internet, which is a tremendous thing, you have information in outside cultures that are getting into these repressive regimes, and you see that the population is starting to awaken with a higher consciousness and realize that those are things that should not be done. And that's part of what's tipping the world over to the side of good, and it's actually the progress is escalating rapidly. So change is happening now, we could say in decades or years or months even, which in the past could have taken hundreds of years.
That's right. And I think that this is a predestiny, if you will, that this period of time is the time where we are supposed to be shifting into a higher consciousness. Let's take this call. Caller, good morning. Welcome to What Matters.
You know, the United States is supposed to be a religious backing by our Constitution when we say in God we trust, right? Where does it give our government the right to go over and actually put a bullet in bin Laden's head and say that was underneath God's commandment?
Okay, well, let's ask our caller if you want to just touch on that. Does the government get permission or the right to go into other countries and kill other leaders?
There's a general principle in Torah law, both for Jews and non-Jews, which is the law of a pursuer, which is a law of self-defense, that you can protect yourself against someone who is coming to kill you, God forbid, or to inflict severe bodily injury. By the person coming as a murderer, he has basically forfeited his right to life. These laws are not only ideas, but they're also responsibility and their punishments that the person is liable to. And if the person has the intent to come and murder an individual or on a grand scale, is what happened with bin Laden. He is a pursuer. He is putting other people's life in jeopardy. So an individual or a nation has a lawful right to do what they need to do to protect themselves.
And I think that you've explained that with the pursuer aspect of it. Let's go on to one of the other. We've covered six of them. No, there are two more. Yeah, what are the other two, according to the Noahide laws?
The next one is the prohibition against forbidden sexual relations.
So like adultery, would you say?
Well, it's actually specific. There are six categories of relations that the Torah law forbids absolutely for non-Jews. You can derive them from a single verse that was said in Genesis. I'll just read it. It says, when man and woman were created, Adam and Eve, the statement is made that therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and cling to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. So from that we can see a number of categories, which are that number one is incest. A man and his mother may not have relations. To leave the father means to not associate with the father's wife. So a woman who was married to the father, the son cannot have relations with that woman.
Okay, so there's varying levels of incestuous relationships which they discuss. just to give it a little bit of context here, it seems to us in this day and age, well, of course you wouldn't want to do that. You know, there's laws against that. But we're talking about laws and commandments that were brought through the Torah, through the Old Testament, from 3,000 years ago, during a time period in history where it was a very, very dark time, where killing anybody was okay, where murder was not, it was something you could do if you wanted to, and where there were no court systems set up, and where incest was okay and was allowed. And so we take it for granted today that these things, that there's laws against these types of behaviors, but we have to look at it in context. What an incredible enlightened document to be bringing this kind of system of society where they were bringing some order into the mayhem.
Well, it's not so abstract anymore because the world is really on a slippery slope right now. If you look at what's happening in Europe, for example, say, just take the example of France, incestuous relationships in France are no longer subject to any government penalties.
Oh, this is they've changed the law now so that incest is okay in France?
They don't say that it's permitted, but they say that there's no penalty, which basically that means that it's up to the individual's choice. And then the individual has to decide, well, is this moral or do I have some standard to make boundaries on my behavior or is it free-for-all?
So it's kind of leaving it up to the human with our little small minds to be able to determine what's right and what's not right from our own perspective.
Right.
Okay.
The relations between a brother and his maternal sister is another one of the degrees that are forbidden in the Noahide Code. Another is homosexuality, which is a very hot topic these days, and bestiality.
But to me, the way that I see it is the birthing pangs and the birthing pains of coming into this new world, a world of more of an enlightened consciousness, a higher consciousness. And it might seem difficult to see that way, but people are collectively and individually raising their consciousness and bringing more light and peace into this world. I'm going to just take this call before you give us what the last one is.
Yeah, I was calling. He said Adam and Eve. How many kids did Adam and Eve have? They had two boys, right?
They had five children, according to the Jewish tradition. It is hinted to in the text of Genesis that with the first child, Cain, there was a twin sister born. And with the second child, Abel, there were two twin sisters born. So then you ask, how did humanity become established if there was one family and there was a prohibition against incest? The answer is that there was a special dispensation that God made for them, that the brothers were allowed to marry their sisters as a special dispensation in order to populate the world. And that's the meaning of a verse that is in the book of Psalms. It said the world was built with kindness. And it was a kindness that God did that he allowed incest for the children of Adam in order to establish the world. But then once the children were established, and within the Noahide Code, it's actually permitted for a man to marry his paternal half-sister, if they only have the same father, not the same mother. So very soon they were able to properly observe all those laws.
Okay, thanks for that call, and thank you for answering that. Let's go to the last one of these Noahide laws.
Okay, the last one was given to Noah. It had not been given before the flood, and that is the prohibition against eating meat that was taken from the animal before he died. But that only applies to land mammals specifically and birds. And the reason that it wasn't given before the flood is that in the pre-flood days, human beings were not given permission from God to eat meat. They were vegetarians. But with Noah, who by him saving all the animals, he did therefore earn the right to have use of the animals for his own needs, but not for arbitrary needs and not for the sake of cruelty, only for the sake of a human need, which would be, for example, for eating, for using the hides for leather, using the horns for tools. There's a general principle that is actually like an umbrella over all of the Noahide Code, which is that the world should be a settled and civilized place and that human beings are responsible for taking care of the creation. And part of that means not to waste the resources, and the right to take the life of an animal is only for a human need. So these are things that are in the realm of morality and moral obligations, and people in society should take upon themselves to make rules and standards of behavior in this regard.
But we could have a whole hour discussion on the difference between a human need and a human want. because we have a lot of wants and we don't have that many needs. Our needs are pretty simple. It's what are our wants and our desires and what we become attached to that makes us become overindulgent, really. Thank you so much for joining us, Michael Shulman, the Executive Director of AskNoah.org. If you'd like to go to the website, AskNoah.org.